This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hello there and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, the very best bits of today's show from the 24th of January. It is a Monday morning, the start of a new week. What have we got for you today? Well, we've been talking cryptocurrencies with Ola Dudin of BitOasis. She was the kind of the original Bitcoin bro, if I can use that phrase, back in Dubai 5-6 years ago. We've been speaking to her. Cryptos have been hammered over the past few weeks. Ola's been talking us through that and also what the metaverse might mean for crypto trading here in the UAE. Staying with the digital theme, if you like, we've been talking about Netflix. Their share price has been hammered over the past few days. Fiona Robertson of the law firm Cedar White Bradley gives her take on why Netflix shares have been falling and what happens next. Finally, talking the economics of education. New Zealand, traditionally a magnet for school students and university students from the Middle East and the UAE. But the borders have been shut for 2 years. What does that mean for the economics of education in New Zealand? What does it all mean more broadly for the economics of international education, whether that's school or university? Brandy's been speaking to Amy Rutherford of Education New Zealand. All of that to come. First up, though, here is Serena Kelly with your big stories.
Morning, guys.
Give us the latest on the big story, which is the situation in Abu Dhabi.
So the UAE Ministry of Defense says it has intercepted and destroyed two Houthi ballistic missiles targeting the country. No record of casualties. The statement carried on state news agency WAM said the remnants of the intercepted ballistic missiles fell in separate areas around Abu Dhabi. The ministry added that the country is ready to deal with any threats it faces and will take all necessary measures to protect the state from all attacks. So this comes a week after the Houthis launched attacks on the capital that targeted an airport and oil storage facilities, as you recall. But also Friday evening, the UN Security Council unanimously condemned those first attacks on the UAE by the Houthis. Three people were killed, six others injured in that incident that took place on Monday. But of course, we'll be staying across this story for you this morning.
Thanks very much indeed. Now, drones in the UAE. Serena, you've got an update.
Yeah, something you may have missed over the weekend. The UAE has temporarily banned the use of private drones and the light sports aircraft used for recreational purposes, the small ones that you can buy, the biplanes that you can even put together, those kits. So it's over safety and security concerns. The Ministry of Interior made the announcement on Sunday. It's in coordination with the General Authority for Civil Aviation. So according to a statement, the decision was based on the recent misuse of permits and trespassing into prohibited areas. Now, exceptions are being made, for example, for film crew who may need to use drones for their projects. But you need to make sure you have the right approvals if you're doing that.
Okay, thanks very much indeed. Lots of questions coming in about this episode in the marina over the weekend, Serena. What do we know?
Well, from what we gather, a man was arrested in Dubai for obscene behaviour in public. Dubai Media Office tweeted on Friday saying initial investigations revealed the Arab national was suffering from severe mental disorders. So the statement came shortly after footage of a naked man was walking down the street in the Dubai Marina and JBR area. It was being circulated on social media. But that's all we've had from the Dubai Media Office regarding that.
Thank you very much indeed. Bada writes in saying, Serena, can we have the latest cases and testers, please?
So on Friday, 2,921 cases were announced. Saturday, 3,020. Sunday, 2,813. And that is after more than 517,000 tests were conducted. Your active cases have gone up. Currently, it stands at 55,142.
Question for Serena from Richard from Barsha South. What's the weather like at Expo this morning?
It's really cold.
It was cold walking in, but there is beautiful blue skies. The Australian flag is barely fluttering at the moment. It's a perfect day to come to Expo. I was down here for 3 or 4 hours with my family yesterday. Pro tip, Hungary is brilliant. Water-themed pavilion. Hidden gem is Hungary. Many great pavilions, but really enjoyed Hungary in particular. Who is coming, Serena Kelly, to Expo 2020 Dubai?
Prince William, the Duke of Cambridge, be visiting the UAE next month. Kensington Palace shared the announcement just before the weekend on Friday. His Highness will visit Dubai February 10th. And as you were just saying, Richard, This is also around the same time the UK Pavilion at Expo 2020 Dubai will be celebrating their National Day as well. But Kensington Palace said Prince William hopes to engage with young Emiratis and conservationists during his visit as well, because he intends to showcase his environmental award from last year, the Earthshot Prize, which had its first winners October of last year. Five were each awarded a grant worth just over 4.9 million dirhams. It's developing ideas and technologies to tackle climate change. It is extremely similar to the Zayed Sustainability Prize that was just held recently here in the UAE during Abu Dhabi Sustainability Week. 10 winners across five different categories there as well.
Royal correspondent Tom Urquhart is with us in the studio. Morning, Tom.
Morning, all.
Will he be bringing his mallet with him? Any polo likely for Prince William?
Not that I've heard of. I mean, it's pretty unlikely, one would think.
His brother's more of the polo player, am I right in saying?
I mean, Prince William is a very, very good polo player, and he still plays in a couple of games every year back in the UK, plays in a couple of exhibition games in the UK to support his charities. But yeah, I think it's fair to say that his brother Harry is the keener player of the two.
Serena, a couple of movies have been cancelled.
Let's go to the movies.
I thought we'd gone past this movies being cancelled phase.
No, I'm sorry. Tom Cruise, Mission Impossible, the next movies in the franchise have been delayed. So Seven was due out September of this year. Now, you're not going to get to see that until next year, 2023, in July. And then number Eight has been delayed until June of 2024. That was due out July of 2023. But Paramount Pictures and Skydance said in a statement, the delay is because of the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic.
Favourite Mission Impossible movie in the franchise?
Oh, definitely the one with the Burj Khalifa.
Okay, fine. Thomas Urquhart, you Mission Impossible fan?
Ghost Protocol.
Yeah, good. I think it's Three. Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Oh, he was brilliant, wasn't he?
The Rabbit's Foot.
Yeah, very good.
That was an absolute cracker. Brandy, is it even worth asking you? You Mission Impossible fan?
I've seen the first one.
Okay. So that's your favourite then, isn't it?
It would be, yes, from a wide pool of one. I'm voting for the first.
Serena Kelly, thanks very much indeed.
More details on the Erin News Centre app.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
One of Netflix's latest heavyweight new releases that they penned a lot of hope on was, of course, Don't Look Up, starring Leonardo DiCaprio and Jennifer Lawrence. But maybe they'd have been better versed if they said Don't Look Now, as according to many of the Netflix executives, the latest figures don't look good. Netflix stock has tumbled 41% from an all-time high it hit just 2 months ago. It's gaining subscribers at a painfully slow pace at the moment, and the competition is heating up. So what do you do if you're an exec? You act your prices up, don't you, for your North American customers, and you put everyone else on alarm as to when their price of subscriptions is going to go up. What's going on at Netflix? Let's find out now from the partner, head of media and technology practice at Cedar White Bradley, Fiona Robinson, joins us live on the line. Fiona, thanks so much indeed for your time.
Absolute pleasure.
What's happening at Netflix?
What's happening at Netflix? Well, they've just released their Q4 numbers and they missed a couple of marks. To be honest, they didn't miss them by an awful lot, but I think the market has been very kind to Netflix over the past year, and they've sort of had a look back now and said, actually, they're not the numbers that we wanted for that year. I think there's a couple of things that have happened here. Obviously, in lockdown, Netflix weren't able to produce their originals, and they did announce at the beginning of the year that they were going to go heavy into originals, and they did. And originals cost an awful lot of money. But if you have a look at 6 of the 10 most viewed programs on Netflix for 2021, 6 of them were Netflix originals. So it worked. It was a great strategy. People are watching their content, but it comes at a cost. And I think that's what the market's also making them pay for now.
I mean, there seems to be two things at play here. One is the price rises that people are grumbling about. The other one is this sluggish sign up of new subscribers. I mean, where are they going to find new subscribers? Because they seem to have sort of done their job in the United States, surely.
Yeah, there's no question. The United States is a pretty busy market for video on demand services. You know, they've got HBO Max as a standalone. They've got Apple TV. They've got Disney Plus out there. I think that market's a really busy and engaged market with this. where Netflix is seeing most of its growth is outside of the US. And for 2021, that was EMEA, actually. So Europe, Middle East, Africa was where they were getting their highest growth market. The Middle East in particular is a very young market when it comes to VOD. So we're still seeing players coming into the market. There's a lot of movement here and there's still a lot of potential in the market. So Netflix, if it's sensible, will be looking outside of the US for sure. It's interesting that they're not talking about the price hike very much. That's being kept very much under the radar. But I think from consumers, that is going to make a difference. Because if you're in the US and you've, say, got three subscriptions and they all go up just a little bit in price, you might look at dropping one. And we don't – I mean, the churn numbers are actually a really important part of where that valuation is going to sit. And they're quite hard to find.
It's one that we were talking about over lunch yesterday because, yeah, I mean, what they whacked it up by about a dollar or something. And I think the subscription was round about the sort of $15 mark at the moment, which you'd sort of think isn't going to break the bank. But then again, I suppose if you compare that to the very competitive market and competitive rates, a dollar does matter, doesn't it?
Absolutely, it does. If Disney's doing it at 10 and you're doing it at 15 or 13, people will think, well, which one do I want? And again, it's that thing of if there's a dollar on Disney and then there's a dollar on Netflix and there's a dollar on Amazon Prime, suddenly people say, well, do we need all three of them? You know, it is only $3, but do we watch them all? Do we really need it? People are looking at where their dollars are going these days.
Just a quick one and a little aside as well, because maybe you can solve an argument over our lunch table yesterday. Just something that cropped up going, we were looking at sort of subscription prices for something like a Netflix and looking at $15. And then we were looking for a monthly subscription to Sky and Sky's offerings, over £50 sterling as well. Why is Sky so expensive?
I think Sky is pretty much used mostly by businesses, and with businesses they tend to add a bit of a premium. That would be my answer. That's a very off-the-cuff answer, but I think that's the answer.
Should we be worried about the future of streaming because of these latest numbers from Netflix?
I don't think so. I think the market's still learning how to value streaming and how to understand their numbers. So, you know, there'll be a little bit of settling, and I think obviously it's a very busy market. So, you know, the prediction is that we'll probably lose a couple of the streamers over the next year or two, and that consolidation should be nice for people like Netflix, who obviously have a fairly strong base in business.
There is another argument that this is being blown out of proportion, these figures, and this is a Wall Street story, a market story, rather than a streaming story. Is there something in that?
I think there's quite a lot in that. I mean, I did have a look at the numbers, and, you know, they did match their revenue predictions. And although they missed the membership growth that they had predicted, they didn't miss it by a lot. It was sort of, they said it would be 8.5 million and they got 8.3 million. So I do think Wall Street is giving a bit of a kick to Netflix. But I think it's just, this is a accumulated kick. It's not just from the Q4. I think it's from a bit more than that. I think it has to be.
Moving our attention to other stories that caught the attention. This is an interesting one. These two US fans who've taken on none other than Universal Pictures. They're suing Universal for what?
They're suing Universal because they saw the trailer for a film called Yesterday, which featured a lady called Ana de Armas, who apparently they're very big fans of. Actually, quite famously, Anna was in the original cut of Yesterday, which is a film about the Beatles. I don't know if you've seen it. But she was cut from the final version because audience didn't like the storyline that involved her. So what's happened is, of course, when the film has been delivered to Amazon Prime for people to watch it in the US, and you have to pay for it to get it, it's a premium feature. The trailer that they've used on Amazon still shows her in the film, and these fans have said that her fame, radiance and charm were very much missing from the film, and they're suing as a class action for everyone who had to sit through the film without her in it. They're suing for $5 million.
They're going to get it?
There has been a similar case on this, in fact, weirdly, about 5 years ago. They didn't get it then either. I think the judge is going to say, does the film look like the trailer, yes or no? In that case, it hasn't been deceptive. I don't think they'll get it. But they're getting a lot of attention, and I think perhaps that's what they were after.
Morning, Fiona. Richard here. Quick question just before we let you go about local Arabic content on streaming platforms this year. Who's going to be creating the really, really good stuff? We know that Netflix and Stars Play are two of the biggies here. We got Amazon Prime as well, and others. You know, NBC is very active as well. Who's going to be investing in quality original content here?
I think that the two big players is going to be Shahid, which is obviously the NBC player, and OSN, who are coming to the party this year as well. So I think they're going to be the two players that are going to be providing us with volumes of quality Arabic language content. I think Netflix is really interested in the market, and they've certainly done quite a lot in the past. Whether that will continue, I'm not aware of. I've got my eye also slyly on Amazon Prime. The interesting thing about them, as I've always said, is that they're not driven by having to make profit from Amazon Prime itself. They're obviously there to drive people to consume through Amazon.com. I see them looking at this region with great interest. So I'll be keeping my eye on them this year.
Appreciate it, Fiona. Thank you so much indeed for your time this morning and running the line on a couple of the big media stories for us. Fiona is the partner, head of media and technology practice at Cedar White Bradley.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
And we are broadcasting to you from Expo today, back in our Expo studio. And down here at the event, it is the International Day of Education. Number of delegations from around the world talking about what they are doing with education during COVID. And amongst those is one of New Zealand's higher education professionals. Now, these are the people who are tasked with attracting students down under. But how do you do that when the borders are closed? So I sat down this weekend with Amy Rutherford. She is the regional director for New Zealand, for the Middle East, Americas and Europe for Education New Zealand. I wanted to get a feel for how COVID was affecting international education as a business.
Pre-COVID, there were about 115,000 international students in New Zealand, and they contributed over $5.2 billion to the New Zealand economy. Now, coming up to the beginning of the first semester in New Zealand, so students would normally start in February, we think there'll be less than 20,000 students, international students in New Zealand. So it's quite a significant drop.
So you're talking about less than 20% of what you'd normally see?
Yes, and that's because the New Zealand borders remain closed. So there are some exceptions for international students to enter New Zealand. So there's been some PhD students, for example, coming back into New Zealand, but not that general entrance of those large numbers of students coming to study in New Zealand.
So what has that meant for the economy, those students not being there? What has it meant for revenue, for jobs?
So international education pre-COVID supported almost 49,000 jobs in New Zealand. So there has been quite a significant effect on our education providers. The New Zealand government also has and has had quite a large sort of support of general businesses in New Zealand, wage subsidies, all of that kind of thing. So in terms of the economic effect, I'm not entirely sure that we've really seen it yet.
So let's talk about the Gulf. Large number of students head out internationally from here. What would you normally see coming from the Gulf and from the UAE?
So from the Gulf region, about 2,000 students from across the Gulf region. The majority of those students come from Saudi Arabia because of the scholarship programs that the Saudi government supports. And then probably actually from the Gulf region, the second largest group of international students in New Zealand are from Oman. From UAE, there are probably not that many international students, but there are quite large kind of partnership programs between New Zealand education providers and partners in the UAE.
And how much has that dropped?
Well, in 2020, which is where we have the probably the most recent data, the number of students from the Gulf halved. So from the year before, that was actually quite good because they stayed in New Zealand.
So what have you put in place for those students who have been in New Zealand during COVID? I mean, presumably borders shut, students have been stuck there. Tell me what's been going on.
Large numbers of students, as part of their studies, they work in New Zealand as well. And with lockdowns and things, there was an effect on students' employment. And so there was a hardship fund that was established by the government of $1 million in order to support students who are in New Zealand during this difficult time. But in terms of the situation now for those students who still remain in New Zealand, it's quite normal.
Normal as in what? They can go to the shops, go to a movie?
And also usually study in person as well. Because the number of COVID cases in New Zealand is very, very small at the moment. It's only about I think, between 20 and 30 cases a day. So life is still quite significantly normal.
Do you have students there, though, that haven't been home for a couple of years?
Yeah, and that is one of the things. I mean, in order for them to go home, they would have to get an exception under that in order to re-enter New Zealand, and that's quite difficult. So, yes, some students haven't been home since the borders closed at the beginning of 2020.
And how do you support them practically and emotionally with that?
So New Zealand has always had excellent support for international students. So there's a code of practice for the pastoral care of international students that was established in the early 2000s, and that was world leading. So there's always been excellent student support, and I think during this time too, education providers have recognised the difficulty that international students specifically face being far away from home. And so they're increasing that support as well to students. There's also a program called Tū Ngātahi, which Education New Zealand, who I work for, created. So it means stand together. So we're standing together with our international student community as well.
What does this mean for your job, for you and your team? Education is in some ways a business, and you do look to attract international students in. What kind of story can you tell at the moment for a country whose borders are closed? And the latest thing we heard from, I think, Chris Hipkins was that there weren't going to be any new MIQ places opening up for the foreseeable future.
It is difficult. I have a team that's based across the Americas, the Middle East and Europe. And so at the moment, we've been working with around partnership development. So developing the kind of partnerships that we need in order to help the international education sector recover in the future and also make it that future-proof as well. So we've run programs, for example, across the Americas, the Middle East and Europe, like a Korerorero program, a Conversations That Matter program, where we have conversations with international education experts talking about what education is going to look like in the future. We've also run masterclass programs, so have New Zealand academics teach masterclasses. In my region, in Latin America, for example, we had 10,000 people register to take those masterclasses.
But at the moment, presumably you're not actively recruiting students to come to New Zealand, or am I wrong?
So not to come to New Zealand. We're making those preparations so when the borders do reopen that students can return to New Zealand. But we have just launched a new website that's called Study With New Zealand. In the past, we had Study In New Zealand. We've recognised that students may want to start their studies online with New Zealand providers and then move to New Zealand once the borders reopen in the future.
Are you worried about the effect on the reputation of New Zealand in terms of a place to come and study when you get headlines like the Hermit Kingdom?
I mean, yes, there is definitely an element of that. But I also think New Zealand is known for being a welcoming country. And at the moment, the priority is looking at the health and safety of New Zealanders and people who are living in New Zealand, not just New Zealanders, but international students and other people in New Zealand as well. I think once the borders reopen, New Zealand, which has that reputation for being friendly and welcoming, we will regain that reputation again.
And that is Amy Rutherford, Regional Director for this region, as well as the Americas and Europe at Education New Zealand.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast,
where we are talking cryptocurrencies with one of Dubai's original Bitcoin barons.
And I'm a Bitcoin baron, I'm staring the status quo. Got that crypto going at that foul to flow. In the algorithm, gonna get him until prison sentence on a prison. And that's a nerdy living. I'm a Bitcoin baron, I'm staring the status quo. Got that crypto.
And our Bitcoin Baron this morning is Ola Dudin. She is the CEO and co-founder of BitOasis, and she joins us now live on the line and live on Microsoft Teams. Ola, good morning. Good to have you with us.
Morning, Richard. Glad to be here.
Hey, it's good to have you with us. So, over the past 6 weeks or so, we've had a massive sell-off in cryptocurrencies. Just before Christmas, my Bitcoin was worth more than $60,000. Today, it's worth just $35,000. What's the story?
Yes, I mean, the Bitcoin and the cryptocurrency market is a very volatile market. We've seen this in years before. There are times where it's a bull market and there are times where it's a bear market. Like we always say, and, we also stress that to all our clients at BitOasis as well, it's a volatile market. It is affected by the macro outlook, what's happening in the news, the stock market as well. Obviously, it goes into cycles. But what we've seen over the last 3 to 5 years is that it is a top performing asset, and it continues, weathering any, bear sentiment or any news around its ban or any setbacks, and it continues growing in price. This time around, I think there are different factors. Obviously, that's a short-term outlook in terms of what's going on, of course. We've seen recently a tightening of the monetary policy in the U.S., and there was a recent ban in Russia as well. So that does affect the price in the short term. However, it's an asset that continued having a very growing demand, and it's becoming more and more de-risked. So let's see how it looks like. I think, all financial markets are actually experiencing a setback right now. And the Bitcoin crypto market is no different. But again, I think the sentiment in the long term overall from institutional or retail is very bullish.
So you've been involved in this space for a long, long time, well before it was cool, Ola. You were talking to us about cryptocurrencies. In terms of volumes on BitOasis over the past 6 weeks, are they higher than this time last year, lower than this time last year, or about the same? Because selling pressure doesn't mean there's no volatility. As an exchange, I guess you need volume, don't you?
Yeah, so 100%. So overall, what we've been seeing is that in terms of number of active users, or let's say signups, or people getting into the crypto space, it's been continuously growing. So I think this month, although it's actually a lower volatility month, or a month, I would say, where the sentiment overall, perhaps in the retail market, is more bearish, the number of users that we've got actively transacting on the platform or coming in and buying for the first time is around 4 or 5x what it was January of last year, right? And January of last year is when the price of Bitcoin was just skyrocketing. It started kind of around November 2020 and just continued through the first quarter of 2021. Now, volumes obviously vary, and I think volumes overall in terms of average, monthly volumes, it has been consistently growing compared to, for example, this quarter compared to previous quarters. But one factor that we always look at, because, volumes is very, very volatile, and it gets affected, not even within 24 hours, I would say within like an hourly basis. But what we look at is users who are getting into crypto for the first time and who are continuing to stay active. And that number continues being in the order of 4 to 5 multiples of what it was 12 months ago. So it's definitely been growing in terms of adoption, specifically in the UAE. So I'm actually referencing here the UAE specifically versus other countries that we're in, because we serve the wider, Gulf market. But definitely the adoption levels in terms of retail, it is at an all-time high in the UAE this year compared to previous year, or even previous years that we've been in the market, 2020 and before.
Let's have a look, though, at where we're going for 2022. We've got Goldman Sachs saying that we could see 4 interest rate hikes from the Fed, and a lot of people this weekend, people like the founder of Galaxy Digital, coming out and saying that changes the outlook for crypto. He's saying that we could be facing a crypto ice age.
So I think there are different views, obviously, in the market. And after every bull market, there is a bear market that follows that, right? That's, I think, the natural cycles of things. I think the macro outlook overall is actually kind of trending towards potentially a bear market. Now, how long that bear market would be? Is it similar to the previous 2 years that we had, or more than 2 years? That was, kind of post 2017, all the way up to like 2020. Or is it, a, let's say, short-term, bear market where, the price of Bitcoin or the price of cryptocurrencies would bounce back, after a quarter? I think what we've seen in the crypto market is that the more and more assets being adopted, be it on alternative assets like, Bitcoin, Litecoin, etc., or DeFi protocols, or metaverse-like protocols, that where essentially this adoption cycle continues, and you've got bull and bear markets, depending on the type of the asset in the cryptocurrency market, you're almost kind of getting into a stage of like a super cycle, right? So where you've got certain assets appreciating and depreciating independently of how Bitcoin is performing. And I think overall, the more assets that are in the space, the more assets are being diversified in terms of people investing in it. You'll see different performances overall. But I think what we're seeing right now is that perhaps it's like a bear market post to the bull market that we've seen, you know, last year and, you know, towards end of, last year overall, beginning of this year. So that is...
Oh, look, I'm going to jump in. We've only got 20 seconds left. You mentioned the metaphors there. Things like Mana, things like Sandbox, things like Decentraland. 20 seconds on what impact they're having on the crypto market.
Oh, yes. I think that's among the most exciting trends that are happening in the crypto space right now. There's definitely perhaps a lot of noise and hype, but there's definitely an underlying fundamental innovation that is being looked at, that a lot of companies, from Meta to Nike, to like large brands, really looking at the impact of, you know, NFTs and the future of digital collectibles, and how would that impact the user experience and consumer behaviors online.
That's Ola Dudin of BitOasis.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.